Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly in for Cecilia Mason. This week, we'll hear from a coal miner fighting for black lung benefits.
You think that you would have enough evidence to help you with what needs that you have. But apparently, the way the system is, it doesn't always work that way.
An organization in West Virginia is working to find creative ways to bring fresh foods to a city.
Imagine 1,000 apple trees planted on the contour with another 500 blueberry plants and several hundred blackberry and raspberry plants all growing on trellises all over the hill.
And potters are finding good use for ingredients of acid mine drainage.
The idea of using this iron that is, you can produce the same results that's actually being generated as a byproduct of a stream recovering is a nice idea.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Throughout Appalachia, coal miners have been battling to get black lung benefits for decades. The deadly disease brought on by inhaling coal dust often complicates medical treatment. I recently met a retired West Virginia coal miner who shared his battle for benefits. It starts with a denial letter for a consultation about a lung transplant. The appointment could be the beginning of his road to recovery after battling the lung disease for years.
You think that you would have enough evidence to help you with what needs that you have. But apparently, the way the system is, it doesn't always work that way.
Robert Bailey was a coal miner for 36 years. He began in McDowell County, and after it became too hard to breathe, he retired from a mine owned by Patriot Coal in Boone County.
Mostly because my health, my breathing, my black lung condition. Got where I felt like I couldn't perform the way that I felt like I needed to, even though at the time it was one of the best jobs that I had in my mining career.
Bailey is carrying a bag with an oxygen tank on his back. Medical tubes wind from the tank around his ears and over his slender cheeks, carrying oxygen through a periodic puff to his nose.
I got it on pulse. That way it only comes out when I inhale, so it makes the tank last longer.
In 2009, Bailey first filed for disability and black lung benefits. After a few years of evaluations and paperwork, the United States Department of Labor determined that he deserved a monthly payment and medical care, which is a feat in itself. All the while, Bailey was struggling just to breathe.
A person don't really understand. It's almost like drowning. You might breathe as hard as you can breathe, but you can't feel the air. You're not getting any quality, no use out of it, even though you are breathing. It just don't help you. And you feel your whole system shutting down, and like you're about to melt to the floor.
An investigation into the misconceptions of black lung and maze of benefits by the Center for Public Integrity revealed a system in which coal miners were fighting an unfair battle for benefits. CPI found that the industry's go-to law firms had been withholding evidence that proved miners qualified for benefits because they had the debilitating disease, pneumoconiosis, or black lung. It also found that certain doctors rarely and sometimes never diagnosed patients to have the disease.
It's a struggle just to receive the help that you still need. I'm in the process of a lung transplant, but black lung insurance is protesting any further treatment toward this case.
Bailey says he had tests done to rule out cancer, similar to Gary Fox's case, which was at the center of the CPI investigation. Like Fox, doctors determined that Bailey needs a lung transplant. Doctors confirm Bailey is in a race against the clock.
I asked them, after my evaluation was done, how long I would have to wait before I got on a donor's list, and they told me that as soon as my testing was done, that they would put me on the list. So that tells me that they don't think that my lungs have very much life left in them. But now I'm in a waiting game of waiting on the insurance to verify their approval for me to receive this treatment.
Unfortunately, former miner Gary Fox died while waiting on a transplant. Doctors made an appointment at a hospital in Virginia about Bailey's lung transplant. The original date was May 27th, but in a letter dated April 23rd, Patriot Coal's insurance company, Underwriters Safety and Claims, informed Bailey the company was not approving the next appointment. The insurance company said it wanted to see more medical records. The letter gave no timeline indicating when they would make the decision, except to say later.
Even after I have been awarded Social Security on pneumonicosis and been awarded black lung by a federal judge, they still want to review my medical records to prove that black lung is the reason for my need of a transplant. And before they approve this, they refuse any further treatment toward a lung transplant.
When the time came for Bailey to make the trip to Virginia, he still didn't have answers. So we called Underwriters to see what needed to be evaluated, since Bailey was already approved for black lung benefits and was receiving them. Bailey's medical records from Bluefield Regional Medical Center indicated two mostly black biopsies and findings of severe complicated pneumoconiosis or black lung. But the company would not comment, even with Mr. Bailey's permission. So we reached out to Patriot Coal. Shortly after we sent that email inquiring about black lung benefits, we heard from Bailey as he traveled to his appointment. He said the insurance just approved coverage of the visit. Then, in an email, Janine Orff, Vice President of Investor Relations with Patriot Coal, said, "As with all health care benefits, procedures are in place for medical professionals to review individual cases and determine appropriate treatment. Patriot continues to provide approved black lung benefits in accordance with our commitments. Patriot cannot comment on individual medical cases."
Well, my oldest grandchild is 20. My youngest one is 2 years old, so it would give me hope of seeing them getting their lives more intact. And life is great. So.
Through it all, Bailey says he's not angry. He's put the situation in God's hands and depends on his faith to guide him.
Transplant, don't really want. I'm hoping for greater things. I'm hoping for a healing, but I leave that in the hands of God, you know, whichever direction I have to go, whether it's through healing or transplant or whatever.
Bailey says Patriot's insurance company, Underwriters Safety and Claims, also approved three more appointments that are expected over the next few months, but does reserve the right to further evaluate coverage for the actual transplant. Advocates are still reeling about the chemical spill that left more than 300,000 West Virginians without access to clean water. One company is using the ancient method of theater with hopes to keep the dialogue about water. Liz McCormick of West Virginia Public Radio has more.
On January 9, 2014, an estimated 10,000 gallons of MCHM, a chemical used to clean coal, spilled into West Virginia's Elk River. The result was catastrophic, leaving 300,000 West Virginians in the Kanawha Valley with unusable tap water. Coincidentally, that same day in Brooklyn, New York, the New Brooklyn Theater, a company whose mission is to perform theater wherever theater is uniquely needed to move forward public conversations, opened a production of Edward Albee's The Death of Bessie Smith inside the Interfaith Medical Center in Bed-Stuy when it was threatened with closure. The company was founded 3 years ago by artistic director Jonathan Solari, and he was already thinking about what the company might perform next, as news of West Virginia's water crisis reached him.
Immediately, I was bombarded with emails from activists in New York who were from West Virginia, tweets and all sorts of things, photos of the brown water in the bathtubs, and I was just thinking, what is going on? So we did a little bit more research as information became available, or information did not become available, and started speaking with people who were either from Charleston, from West Virginia, and started getting a sense of it.
Solari and the rest of the New Brooklyn Theater chose Henrik Ibsen's An Enemy of the People, hoping it would address the water crisis and act as a platform for the citizens of Charleston to speak out about what's been happening. As part of their motto, the New Brooklyn Theater likes to perform in unusual spaces.
So now we're trying to ground this great story in West Virginia and in a way that speaks directly to our audience and to this situation.
An Enemy of the People deals with a man named Dr. Stockman, who's been seeing symptoms in the town that have caused him concern. Thinking it could be the water at the local baths that is the basis of the local economy, he runs a test, finding out that the water is being polluted and has been for the last 10 years.
So the play is about his fight to try to bring that truth to the forefront. The way into the story is through a similar situation that we've been experiencing here since January. But at the heart of it, it's a play about a man who has to discover and come to terms with how difficult it is to do the right thing. But we do that through the lens of polluted water.
To help make their performances come to life, the New Brooklyn Theater casts local actors of the area in which they perform to give the story a more genuine feeling by having actors who have witnessed the issues firsthand.
It's been eye-opening. You know, there's only so much that we could do in terms of pre-production when we're reading newspaper articles and listening to the radio, but to be on the ground firsthand, to be able to collaborate with people that live through it and continue to live through it and have those voices in the room as part of the collaborative process, that's priceless to us.
The key to the New Brooklyn Theater's mission is creating a dialogue about current issues. And Solari says if they're not trying to actually engage with their audience and directly addressing their concerns, then they're not doing their job.
When the play's over, it's not just where are we going to eat right now, but actually something that you can carry with you and will hopefully empower our audience to take ownership for the decisions that are made that affect them and to facilitate that conversation.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Charleston.
And we've got more Appalachian Conversation on tap. After the break, we'll hear from an organization with big hopes to recover from a failing economy with fresh produce. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Skip Johnson was an outdoors writer for the Charleston Gazette. He passed away in 2010, but a book that he completed just before his death, called West Virginia Mountain Lions, The Past, Present, and Future of the Long-Tailed Cat, has recently been posthumously released. One of the chapters is dedicated to a very well-remembered newspaperman and outdoors writer from an earlier generation, Calvin Price, who Johnson calls the Pocahontas Panther Man. Like Johnson, Cal Price was fascinated by the very idea that mountain lions might still roam wild in the woods of West Virginia. For this story, Roxy Todd found a 1956 interview with Cal Price, where he talks about his own encounter with a mountain lion.
There is a photo of Calvin Price, standing with his walking stick beside an enormous hollowed-out tree. Snow surrounds him. He stands in the rugged landscape wearing a black tie and a suit, and brown hiking boots. And his eyes are those of a man who has just climbed a mountain, and for whom this is an everyday occurrence. Calvin Price never drove a car. He walked everywhere, all over Pocahontas County, spending many nights camping in the backcountry. Each week, Price wrote about his adventures and observations out in the forest, and he printed these field notes on the second page of his newspaper, the Pocahontas Times. These stories sometimes documented sightings of mountain lions that were reported to him by people in Pocahontas County. Here he is talking about these panthers in an interview that was recorded in 1956.
We still maintain there's panthers in Pocahontas County. The fact of the matter is, why we were getting ready to follow the lead of New England and establish a kind of a brotherhood or whatever you call it, a lodge, I have seen a panther.
Cal Price had his own sighting of a mountain lion in 1954.
I saw the panther 2 years ago, but I was by myself. Whistled at him, he turned around and growled at me and went off through the woods.
Sightings of mountain lions still persist in West Virginia, but the West Virginia DNR does not recognize these sightings as enough evidence to prove that wild mountain lions still exist in the state. Bob Beanblossom is with the West Virginia DNR.
According to our biologist with DNR's Wildlife Resources section, there is to date no credible evidence that panthers exist in West Virginia. There's numerous sightings, some of them are very reputable people. I know a couple myself that I have utmost respect for that told me that they indeed saw a mountain lion. But beyond a sighting, there's never any scat, there's never any tracks, there's never any evidence to suggest that mountain lions are in West Virginia.
Skip Johnson's posthumous book highlights story after story of mountain lion sightings. In the book, Johnson says, there have been so many reports, in fact, that the question has become not whether mountain lions are being seen, but where are they coming from? For Allegheny Mountain Radio and Traveling 219, I'm Roxy Todd.
Like many towns across much of Appalachia, Wheeling is home to several abandoned, depressed, impoverished areas susceptible to crime and drug epidemics. The region has depended largely on coal and steel industries, which are declining. But a small group of young people is spearheading several local foods initiatives in Wheeling with the hope of ultimately changing all that. Glennis Board of West Virginia Public Radio has more.
Here we are on what looks like a farm, what sounds like a farm, but we're in the city, under a highway overpass. It's called Farm 18 because it's on 18th Street in Wheeling. Danny Swan, co-founder of a fledgling nonprofit called Grow Ohio Valley, describes the scene.
There's a giant highway overpass that kind of forms the background of the garden. And it's the reason why the garden exists. This overpass was the reason they tore down the houses that used to be here on this block and left this big empty field, which we've turned into a mini farm that has chickens and raspberries and blackberries and all kinds of vegetables, anything you can name. Basically with a purpose of growing food in the East Wheeling community, so getting fresh food into the neighborhood and teaching other people how to grow stuff.
Farm 18 has been growing for about 5 years now. Last year, the acre plot produced an estimated $10,000 worth of organic produce, sold in farm stands and distributed throughout the community. This year, Swan says, with a lot of volunteer effort and resources, they hope to produce $20,000. And again, all of these organic vegetables are being grown on top of filled-in foundations of a former neighborhood.
Realized that we couldn't till this ground like you normally would in a garden. You can't dig because of the houses that used to be here. A couple inches down is all rubble. So we started using this no-till style of gardening where you're just layering things from the top down, putting down mulches and killing the grass by using newspaper instead of a rototiller. So basically smothering the grass and then mulching all the time. And it was really amazing to see over the years the soil quality start to improve and the crop production, you know, rivaling that of the best soils in the world here on, you know, like, abandoned urban rubble. It's been really cool.
Farm 18 looks like a pretty intense operation, but it's just one of the projects Grow Ohio Valley is tackling. A handful of volunteers are spearheading a group of ambitious projects that are all designed to bring healthy food into Wheeling and teach kids what that food is and how it's grown. And they've made some serious headway. In addition to Farm 18, there are about 20 small community gardens growing in Wheeling now, where 5 years ago, there were just many empty lots in neighborhoods known as drug and crime hotspots.
And it's really, really true that if you build farms in neighborhoods and a lot of good food, the value of everything else goes up around it.
Executive Director of Grow OV, Ken Peralta. A filmmaker with an MBA from Harvard Business School, Peralta blew in from New York City several years ago with a mission to explore food and sustainability. Lucky Wheeling. Since he got here, he's co-authored a Benedum-funded study that outlined the region's potential to develop a local food economy. Now armed with blueprints of how to build healthy, sustainable, economically strong communities, Grow Ohio Valley is fundraising and putting their ideas in motion. The fundraising is going pretty well. So far, they've landed some key grants from the state, local foundations and institutions, as well as individual donors, to the tune of a couple $100,000. Most recently, the Schenck Charitable Trust awarded them their largest grant yet, $150,000, to fund these efforts. Peralta says they're basically making offers that are really just too good to pass up.
You know, it's like the triple bottom line returns. It's the financial returns. It's the returns to the environment, because if you're growing food, you're enhancing fertility and you're building kind of mini ecosystems. So there's big benefits there. And then also the health and well-being of the people, both through eating better food, as well as getting people active in their gardens and thinking about what they eat, you know, thinking about, gosh, what I put in my body changes the way that I feel.
Peralta is excited that their plans are set in motion, and those plans encompass more than Farm 18 and the urban community gardens, much more. So, I am bushwhacking my way through Wheeling, the city of Wheeling. If I didn't know better, I'd say the zombie apocalypse had come and gone.
So we're walking, it looks like we're in the woods, but you notice that there's still like streetlights in this path through the woods. So this was a neighborhood that was all torn down 40 years ago and is now regrown up into a 40-year-old forest. An interesting forest because it's got a lot of non-native species that were here from the neighborhood. Like, this is all Rose of Sharon here growing along the old roadside.
That's Danny Swan, co-founder of a new nonprofit called Grow Ohio Valley. He came to Wheeling through Jesuit University. He hails from Morgantown. He's really passionate about growing food, educating youth, and about his community.
And then if you peek back through the weeds and the trees, you'll see that there's old staircases and foundations.
So, oh my God.
You know, and it's like all old.
Look at that.
It's like Roman ruins, you know. It's really cool. It's like.
And how did you discover this?
Just walking the dog. And it's we're right here in downtown Wheeling. So if we just walked a little bit forward, or in fact, if there weren't leaves on the trees right now, what you'd see right there is all of downtown Wheeling. If you had a good arm, you could throw a rock and hit the cathedral downtown.
Really?
It's
But you cannot tell.
Yeah, you're here, right here in the middle of the woods. It's one of the coolest places I know of, and one of the coolest places in Wheeling. It kind of has a Chronicles of Narnia feel, doesn't it? It's pretty weird, yeah. If we just pop through here.
Swan explains landslides on this steeply sloped hillside made the buildings too expensive to maintain. It's totally abandoned here. Now, I grew up in this town, but I have never been here or heard of this place. I've never seen this side of Wheeling, and it's not as if there's nothing to see.
This was apartment buildings where we stand now. So we're standing in a meadow. It's a little more than an acre, and what we see in front of us as we look off to the west is basically all of downtown Wheeling. So there's the arena and the waterfront park, and there's the river behind it. And on the other side, you can see all the way down to Bel Air and up to Martin's Ferry. It's this incredible view, one-of-a-kind view.
It feels somehow like walking back in time. The old Victorian buildings, the mighty Ohio River stretched out as far as you can see. It all looks like one of those tinny, old-time photos you would see framed in a postcard or in a history museum. But it's real. And in years of coming here, Swan says he has never come across anyone else hiking through. Never. and his organization, Grow Ohio Valley, have a plan. They want to take the existing elements here, the overgrown roads and these pretty much perfect public stairways with handrails that traverse the entire hill, and turn them into nature trails, complete with historical and informative signage. And then create a teaching garden in the meadow that overlooks the Ohio Valley. It's actually a convenient location because just up the hill, a little further, is a building that was just gifted to Grow Ohio Valley.
My name is Brandon Holmes, and we are at the future location of Friendly City Foods and also the offices of Grow Ohio Valley.
Holmes is currently covered in drywall dust because he and other volunteers are working on renovating this building. Holmes is a policy analyst for the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition. He's also on the steering committee of Grow Ohio Valley and the project manager of Friendly City Foods. Grow Ohio Valley is taking a page from the Wild Ramp in Huntington and creating this year-round consignment farmers market / retail, local, healthy, natural food store slated to open in July.
We want farmers to be able to come, drop off what they've grown, and not only farmers, but also backyard gardeners, market gardeners, those people that have, you know, an extra half a bushel of tomatoes or zucchini or something that they really did well on. We'll sell those products, we'll take a commission off of them, and then they'll be able to go and do what they do best, which is grow, instead of sitting on the side of the road or sitting at the farmer's market waiting on someone to come and buy their products.
Right. This building will also serve as a distribution spot for Grow OV's Super CSA, entitled Black Swan Organics. For those who are unfamiliar, CSA stands for Community Sustained Agriculture. It's where individuals purchase a subscription and gain access to weekly distributions of produce from local farmers or producers. Distribution is scheduled to begin here on June 18th. So, community gardens, like Farm 18, the 18th Street Mega Community Garden, Friendly City Foods, the Consignment Farmers Market, Lincoln Meadow, which is the inner city growing garden / nature preserve I introduced you to today. Yeah, that's close to about half of what Grow Ohio Valley is up to.
So we're on the corner of 14th and Wood Street in East Wheeling, and we're sitting looking at the future East Wheeling Community Greenhouse. So there's some nice landscaping going on here, a nice entryway into this corner lot, which is a vacant lot.
Grow OV has been awarded $22,000 from the Hess Foundation and other donors to pursue this project. It gets at the heart of what Grow OV is all about, because it's a year-round growing facility, building on historic remnants in the heart of a neighborhood that is in need of some love. The building will be used by residents as a place to grow food to be sold throughout town.
This has been an amazing project because literally everybody has been involved. The guys who hang out here on the corner, you know, college professors, people from the church down the street, kids, grandmas. The way that this project is bringing the community together is the coolest thing about it. And then all the other stuff with the sustainable building design and growing food year-round, that's pretty amazing too, but all kind of serving this higher purpose of uplifting the community.
Danny Swan is like the Pied Piper. I want you to put this in there because I think it's important.
That's Bill Hogan, longtime Wheeling resident. In fact, his family has been in Wheeling for generations.
What he's done, this whole thing has changed, is changing the culture of East Wheeling.
Hogan remembers the days in Wheeling when the population was more like 100,000 instead of the 28,000 that it is today. He remembers when the town was full of apple and pear and cherry trees.
People undervalue people's connection with the ground, with the soil. And he's awakened that. He's got all these gardens in one of the worst stretches of town, and none of them have ever been vandalized, which, you know, it speaks volumes.
Hogan has been credited by Grow Ohio Valley's executive director, Ken Peralta, as playing a pivotal role in getting the nonprofit off the ground.
Ken Peralta moved into the area, and he's, you know, he's a brain and he's a concept player. And the reason he came here is because he's concerned about the global population and the food production isn't going to meet it. he looked at the United States, and the Ohio Valley is one of the most fertile and could be one of the most productive areas in the country for food.
So everything from cultivating multiple community gardens to deploying MOMS, or mobile markets, which are these roving farm stands complete with cold storage options that travel through neighborhoods, selling to everyone from low-income houses to high-rise buildings that house elderly residents. GrowOV is working it, and they have a 7-year plan that ends in sustainability. One of the key projects to help get them there will be hard to miss for drivers whipping by on I-70 North through the Wheeling Tunnels. GrowOV has plans to plant an orchard on the hillside there in the spring. Again, Danny Swan.
So we're thinking about 1,000 apple trees, and they would be dwarf and semi-dwarf trees. So small trees that you don't have to climb a ladder to pick because it's on a hillside and because we want to have kids involved. Imagine 1,000 apple trees planted on the contour with another 500 blueberry plants and several hundred blackberry and raspberry plants all growing on trellises all over the hill. So it'll have that sort of vineyard look to it, and it's going to be pretty cool. Yeah.
GrowOV applied for and was awarded a grant through the West Virginia Department of Agriculture to get the orchard started. The urban orchard proposal was awarded the highest possible amount of $25,000. Executive Director Ken Peralta said the idea of an urban orchard on otherwise unusable fields with a strong educational emphasis and a creative land use partnership with the Wheeling Housing Authority, who owns the land, well, it all made for a winning proposal. And interestingly, the area in North Wheeling where the orchard is planned, it used to be a vineyard. A German priest grew grapes here around the turn of the century to make altar wine. Today, it's too expensive to try to build on the vacant slopes. So fruit is being reintroduced to the Ohio Valley.
The northern panhandle of West Virginia used to be known for its apple production. You know, the Golden Grimes apple got its start in Wellsburg, and Johnny Appleseed was here. And what we're going to do is to build a commercial-scale urban apple orchard with the purpose of putting people to work, teaching kids how to grow food, and to try to get these fruits into local school systems and on local dinner tables.
I think the most exciting part is to see it starting to take shape.
Ken Peralta, executive director.
You know, if there's a 50-acre exercise and food park that's 5 minutes walk from downtown with a organic farm training center on one side and a vegetable processing and storage facility at the top of the mountain and 5 acres of fruit orchards on the other side and steps that traverse the whole hill, the whole city can really be regenerated by a focus on food and fertility and the ecosystem. So I guess knowing what the end game and then seeing people get involved, you know, especially the kids, in the end, that's where the big changes will come from, is changing their mindsets.
He says the immediate goals are increasing production, increasing sales, and creating a full docket of educational programs for kids through adults. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
So that's how one city is looking to revitalize or recover from an economic downturn. And coming up, we'll go even deeper inside Appalachia to find one way an organization is working to help streams recover from acid mine drainage. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Recovering from acid mine pollution can be challenging for water supplies. But there are more ways of making good with the mine water pollution. Get this, the bright orange oxide is being used to color t-shirts, stain wood, and even tint the burnt sienna shade of Crayola crayons. Now potters are using the materials too. This week, we revisit a story we first aired a few months ago. As part of the Allegheny Front's Ripple Effect series, Jennifer Shveta Jordan discovered how pollution is being turned into profit through pottery.
I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan of the Allegheny Front. There are more ways of making good with mine water pollution. Get this, the bright orange oxide from streams is being used to color t-shirts, stain wood, and even tint the burnt sienna shade of Crayola crayons. Now potters are using the materials, too, to decorate jewelry, sculpture, and other ceramic art. As our Ripple Effect series continues, I checked out how pollution's being turned into profit through pottery.
But yeah, this is it. It's just a liquid glaze.
Potter Bob Eisenberg dunks a mug into the grayish liquid. It's manganese.
A lot of times I'll just kind of do it, just shake it around a little bit.
He's always used iron oxide and manganese in commercial glazes that come from around the world. A few years ago, this local alternative became available.
I think because they had larger particles, they did different things. They just were kind of runny, and they had a little like feathery details to them that our other glazes just didn't have.
About a half hour's drive from Eisenberg's studio is a double-wide trailer where Eisenberg gets his supplies. It's the headquarters of Stream Restoration Incorporated in Mars, near Pittsburgh. The organization helps 20-some watershed conservation groups keep their water treatment systems up and running. Margaret Dunn and Ryan Mahoney walk around the back of the trailer.
Okay, Ryan, can you explain what we have in these sacks in the back?
Sure. When a system kind of reaches an age where it's getting clogged or there's too much manganese or iron in it, we go out and recover the materials. For the iron, it's kind of go get some interns or shovel it into the bags. So it's kind of a dirty process.
Then they spread and dry it out. The groups pulled more than 20 tons of iron and manganese out of just a couple streams. Mahoney demos the next step, flipping on a commercial sifter.
It's going to be a little loud. Basically, once you turn it on, you just put the material in and it shakes and distributes.
The potters ask for particular sizes?
Yeah, some potters like larger sizes, some like raw materials, some like it very fine.
It goes anywhere from like the diameter of a pencil down to like as small or smaller than the point of a pencil.
Kind of like a fine dust for the smaller stuff.
This whole operation came about after Dunn had a surprising conversation a few years ago.
My best friend, who is a potter, she recognized the material that we were collecting in our systems when we were treating mine drainage could be used by potters. She made a few pieces, and now we have 7 potters that contribute, and all the money from the sale of the material and from the pottery goes to help watershed groups sustain the treatment of their systems.
They call this project Clean Creek Products. Inside the trailer, Dunn shows off pieces made with glaze. They're artsy modern works, naturally, in earth tones. $20 to $30 for mugs, $25 for a set of earrings.
I typically wear some. I should have had some on today.
A sake set, flasks, and tea kettles round out the collection. And if it seems counterintuitive to drink from a cup made from what pollutes streams, well, Dunn explains it this way.
We've had the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, we've run tests to make sure that it could be used in the pottery safely and for food, and it meets all the criteria, and we were just surprised.
Do people ask that, though?
You know, if you're taking a multiple vitamin, you're taking iron and manganese. When there's too much iron, then fish can't live. You know, it tends to kill the stream.
Dunn has endless dreams for how communities impacted by acid mine drainage could benefit from this material. She's investigating whether organizations could get green building points for using the iron oxide and manganese in tile and concrete. When she thinks about the implications, Dunn actually gets choked up.
What got you interested in this kind of work personally?
Personally? Well, I'm originally from southern West Virginia. There's a lot of poverty down there, a lot of mine drainage, and anything to help the communities is what we want to do.
Photos of the pottery made by Bob Eisenberg and others is at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This is The Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. From Pennsylvania to Margaret Dunn's old stomping grounds, a professor at Concord University is recycling the pollution in his pottery and finding it as a useful education tool as well. Jared Klein of West Virginia Public Radio has more.
Jamie Biggs, an art professor at Concord University, uses the unique substance while glazing pottery. He was first approached about the opportunity while showcasing his work at Tamarack.
The discussion around ceramics usually seems to come back to materials. One of the things people want to know about is where does your clay come from? You know, where did that glaze come from? How do you make this stuff? And it comes back to materials over and over and over again.
A woman with the company offered him a free 10-pound sample, and it was a success. The pottery that came out of the kiln showed the same results as other glazes.
So the idea of using this iron that is, you can produce the same results that's actually being generated as a byproduct of a stream recovering is a nice idea, and it's a nice use for the material that would otherwise be treated as waste.
On this day, Biggs has been standing outside monitoring a wood firing of clay. He uses a traditional Japanese method that lasts 44 hours. Biggs explains how the fire works.
As it burns, it produces ash, and the ash lands on the pots, and through the high temperatures and the extended time period, the ash melts and forms the glass on the outside of the pots, as well as melting the glazes on the inside.
Concord student Remington Radford has taken the current shift and loves the way the pottery looks once it's finished.
Just like the turnout, the ash that falls on it, like there's so much differentiation. You're not going to get one piece that's the same. Like, it's all going to be, like, slightly different, if not completely.
Biggs grew up in Summersville and can remember when he was a child the few remaining strip mines before they were shut down. He doesn't consider himself an environmentalist, but says the cleanup is necessary.
You know, these landscapes are the way that they are. We're going to have to deal with this one way or another. So the cleanup, the passive treatment systems are a low-cost way of streams recovering. And I think for 15 years now, that's not a debatable thing. These systems work, and they're very effective. The next step is just maybe finding a purpose for these metals that are recovered.
Biggs, along with fellow Concord professor Norma Accord, published their recipes for making glaze out of acid mine drainage in a magazine and held a presentation early this month. Biggs says the communication that is inspired by sharing the ingredients is what's most important.
The biggest thing about the exhibition is seeing these professional working artists with giving their recipes away. If potters have access to those recipes, it's a little easier to incorporate this new material.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jared Klein in Athens.
Still to come, we'll listen in on a conversation about a new graphic novel that goes into the dark side of coal. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We wrap up this week's show on a somewhat darker note and perhaps an idea for an interesting read. West Virginia writer and filmmaker Danny Boyd's latest graphic novel, Carbon, tells the story of an ancient race of people and their effect on the coal industry thousands of years later as an evil coal baron tries to mine a super form of coal. Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Radio sat down with the writer to find out more.
So, first off, Danny, thanks for being here.
Oh, good to be here, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Great. And so we're talking about Carbon, your new graphic novel that's released regionally right now, and we'll get into how people can get it and when the national release is going to come along. Danny, I want to start off by having you explain the concept of the book. It's called Carbon, obvious reference to coal. But go ahead and take a few moments to explain to listeners what the concept in the storyline of the book is.
That's the problem. It's hard to do in a few moments because it's been rattling around my head in 30 years now since my first introduction to coal living in Williamson and my environmental views that changed over the years. But basically, as an entertainer, I was always looking for a property that could where I could put these pieces into it and still entertain people. And about 10 years ago, it finally hit me. Always go back to the beginnings. Go back to the beginnings. Well, coal was carbon. We are carbon. Coal was formed by plant and animal life, us, over millions of years. What if you reverse that process? So it's that what if, you know, and in the storyline here, there was a civilization before ours, a Garden of Eden, so to speak, where the civilization did not obey God's rules to live in balance, and they were sent underground until the time the earth replenished itself, given immortality. But they stopped caring, stopped praying, and became carbon. Thousands of years later, an evil coal baron finds a piece of it in that sacred pocket and discovers that that carbon will burn forever. So over a 30-year time period, sends expeditions in to get it, not telling them what it is, and they get wiped out by the guardians each time. So anyway, that's about as briefly as I can explain the concept. But David was, you know, I'm a filmmaker, but this was my big Hollywood movie that I just never got to the circles where we could put this kind of budget together. And then when I fell into graphic narrative 5 years ago, it was like, well, holy cow, I can do this now.
The book hits very, very explicitly on issues related to coal and industry in West Virginia. You know, it's a very complex thing here. And also in January, we had the Elk River chemical spill, which, you know, everyone knows what happened to the water supply, and the EPA releasing their clean power plan. Talk a little bit about, I guess, the struggles that you've observed and how you sort of came to terms with being conscious in that way and wanting to politicize it, but very delicately in a book such as this. You haven't really gone there with your work before. Why exactly this issue and why in this form?
Well, I haven't gone there before because I think it's presumptuous of entertainers and artists to take their politics, you know, too blatantly. I purposely waited for, as I said, a property like this where I could cut loose on it, and I really am. I'm fully out now, you know, with this. But I'm not anti-capitalism. I'm not anti-industrial world that we live in. My goodness, we wouldn't have this quality of life. But any normal thinking human being has to realize that the last two industries that you want to regulate themselves are coal and chemical. You know, I'm sorry, greed is going to win out. We need safeguards there. Well, the book had been delayed. It was supposed to come out in January and delayed again. And the publisher kept seeing Charleston, West Virginia on World News, and he called me and said, since we've been delayed, I'm seeing this water thing. Would you like to add something to your afterword about that? And I said, heck yeah, I do. So I sat down and wrote that piece there at the end. So, you know, I mean, the timing is just my good luck. I mean, the timing could have come out with Sago, Upper Big Branch. You know, that's, you know, and I had the idea before those things happened. And that's the last thing in the world I want to exploit. What a horrible thing that we all went through. Not only as West Virginians, but I mean, people all over the world that sympathize with what we're going through. So there was, you know, I wanted to hit that issue of corporate greed at the sacrifice of human life, but also the environmental. I mean, it's just cutting the tops off of mountains and filling valleys and poisoning water supplies. It's just a bad idea.
Talk a little bit about the setting in West Virginia. It takes place down in Mingo County. There's references to Charleston, a few nods to West Virginia State University, mm-hmm. and, you know, Charleston being the capital. Talk a little bit about how the sense of place and the culture and economy, using the place where you live in the region as the framework, and the obvious reasons how that informs the narrative of the story itself.
Well, I mean, it really is geography, a story here. And like I said, my first real job was in Williamson, West Virginia in 1980. And as a West Virginian, I thought I knew coal. I did not know coal. I mean, that was the greatest education I could have ever gotten at the time. And there's been a piece of Mingo County in nearly everything I've written since. It was just such a rich part of my life and a strange place of incredible goodness and incredible badness with it all. So it was very important to get the geography here. I mean, you need to go to the coal fields because it's built different.
And in finishing up with you, what's the hope? I mean, Chillers was an international cult success, the comic book lines, you've done other work. Now with this coming out, is the expectation for this to exceed something than before? Or do you go into it thinking, well, I've set the bar here and anything on top of that is just, you know, icing on the cake? Or is there, when you walked away from developing this and putting the final touches on it, did you walk away saying, this is the best work I've ever done? here's where the bar should sit?
Well, I can tell you, 5 years ago when I made the decision to reinvent myself, I sat down with my daughters, who were adult at that time, and I said, this is what I want to do. I want to take all my savings. I want to put it into this because I have to tell the story. And if I just get the book out, it may not make money. I can be okay with that. Can you be okay with that? And they said, go for it. So everything is icing on the cake, to answer your question. The book is out. The book will be out nationally. But I'm greedy like anyone else. I want a lot more icing. I wanted to pick up enough that I can complete the series. But it's all icing. It's good icing right now.
Great, Danny. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD Land of the Sky by Maggie's Music. Other music heard on today's show was by Andy Agnew Jr. of Burlington, West Virginia, from his album Originals by a West Virginian. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.